This is the fifth day of this November 2007 seven-day session. And we'll return to our text from yesterday, an old book by relative standards of Buddhist books called The Zen Master Hakuin, Selected Writings by Philip Yampolsky. Translated by Philip Yampolsky. I was reading from the first chapter. It's a letter to a governor of a province, a letter from Hakuin to governor of a province, and it's called Orotegama, Part 1. If you suddenly awaken to the wisdom of the true reality of all things of the one vehicle alone, the very objects of the senses will be Zen meditation, and the five desires themselves will be the one vehicle. Thus, words and silence, motion and tranquility are all present in the midst of Zen meditation. When this state is reached, it will be as different from that of a person who quietly practices in forests or mountains, and the state to which he attains, as heaven is from earth. Yung Chia penetrated to the hidden meaning of the Tendai teaching that the truths themselves are one. He polished the practice of Shikan in infinite detail, and in his biography, the four dignities are praised as always containing within them the dhyana contemplation. The four dignities are the four modes of carrying oneself, of walking, standing, sitting, and reclining. The implication here is that this kind of dignity of being present, fully present, not captivated by thoughts in one's minds, but that dignity pervades all of one's activities. You just single out these four to sort of represent all activities. So these four modes are praised as always containing within them the dhyana contemplation. It is the moving meditation, moving zazen. His comment is very brief, but it is by no means to be taken lightly. When he says that dhyana contemplation, that's zazen, is always contained within the four dignities, he is speaking of the state of understanding in which the two are merged. The four dignities are none other than the dhyana contemplation, and dhyana contemplation is none other than the four dignities. When Vimalakirti says that the bodhisattva, without establishing a place for meditation, practices amidst the activities of daily life, he is speaking about the same thing. So this is one of the most persistent errors in practice, is dividing one's practice into the sitting and then, or rather just identifying practice as sitting alone. And then everything else just goes to pot. In Sesshin, we at least stand a chance of starting to integrate this composed mind, this concentrated mind into everything we're doing. And there's so many opportunities in Sesshin. Our daily lives are so simple. We're not attending meetings. We're not doing email. We're not involved in all kinds of decision making. It's just this movement, this walking. You have these long hallways here. What are you doing when you're walking down those hallways? It's all opportunity for continued zazen. There's no need to have the hands in the kinhin position while walking around this complex, but you may find that it works better for you. Just getting off one's mat for kinhin. Just that moment right there, that transition from the sitting to the standing position. Just turning, spinning off your cushion, feet on the floor, standing right there. Why let it go there? Why let the mu go in that transition? There's no reason to drop it. You don't have decisions to make at that moment. It's pretty simple. Feet on the floor, stand up. And of course, kinhin itself, we have the perimeter of the zendo, where you see practically nothing more than the person in front of you. Great opportunity to keep the questioning going, keep the mind free of thoughts. Dropping out of line, go to the water table, pouring the water, pouring it into one's cup. No real decisions have to be made there. Just keep it going then. Placing the cup back on its peg at the water table, going back to the area in front of the zendo to wait to re-enter your place. All that standing there waiting to re-enter your place, more opportunity to just keep it going. But we keep losing it. We keep finding ourselves off in some thought. But it's all right. Just go back to the mu. Simple as pie. Just go back to it. And then 3 seconds later, we find we've lost it again. Oh, just go back. There's plenty more where that came from. Just keep going back. There's no limit. No limit of 2 or limit of 4. Just keep back. I remember getting so sidetracked by by disparaging myself. I'd catch myself with the mind somewhere, and then I'd launch into this. What is wrong with you? You are hopeless. What is wrong? What is so hard about this? Aren't you ever gonna blah 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 blah? It just goes on and on. This is where the devil gets the better of you. This lapsing into this commentary, this self-judgment. Whereas you don't need any of that. You don't want any of that. It's right there. Mu. What? Who? Or if your practice is the breath, just drop it. Of course it's hard. It's hard. But now, you know, sitting 10, 12, 14 hours a day, now we can really have a go at this. And what a difference it makes to then, at the end of kinhin, when sitting back on our mat, to have all those holes filled in, so we don't have to start it up all again. It's been going the whole time during Kinhin, using the bathroom. He goes on, because the lotus that blooms in the water withers when it comes near to fire, fire is the dread enemy of the lotus. Yet the lotus that blooms from the midst of flames becomes all the more beautiful and fragrant the nearer the fire rages. He's talking here about quite an advanced state of being able to keep one's mindfulness on the practice, even in the midst of quite stressful activities. A man who carries on his practice, shunning from the outset the objects of the five senses, no matter how proficient he may be in the doctrine of the emptiness of self and things, and no matter how much insight he may have into the way, is like a water goblin who has lost his water, or a monkey with no tree to climb, when he takes leave of quietude and enters into the midst of activity. Most of his vitality is lost, and he is just like the lotus that withers at once when faced with a fire. A water goblin who has lost his water. A footnote. This water goblin, the Japanese name is kappa. It's even I know that word somehow from just exposure to a little bit of Japanese culture. It's kind of a ghost. This kappa has a depression filled with water in the top of its head. It loses its power if the water is lost. But if you dauntlessly persevere in the midst of the ordinary objects of the senses and devote yourself to pure, undistracted meditation and make no error whatsoever, you will be like the man who successfully delivered the several hundred ryo of gold, despite the turmoil that surrounded him. Dauntlessly and courageously setting forth and proceeding without a moment's interruption, you will experience a great joy, as if suddenly you had made clear the basis of your own mind and had trampled and crushed the root of birth and death. It will be as if the empty sky vanished and the iron mountain crumbled. You will be like the lotus blooming from within amidst the flames, whose color and fragrance become more intense the nearer the fire approaches. Why should this be so? It is because the very fire is the lotus, and the very lotus is the fire. I cannot emphasize enough that the true practice of introspection is an absolute essential that must never be neglected. The true practice of introspection consists of this contemplation. And this is in quotes, the area below my navel down to my loins and the soles of my feet is all Zhao Zhou's Mu. What principle can this Mu possibly have? The area below my navel down to my loins and the soles of my feet is all my own original face. Where can there be nostrils in this original face? The area below my navel down to my loins and the soles of my feet is all the pure land of my own mind. With what can this pure land be adorned? The area below my navel down to my loins and the soles of my feet is all the Buddha Amida in my own body. What truth can this Amida preach? The area below my navel down to my loins and the soles of my feet is all the village where I was born. What news can there be from this native village? This is one of the One of the wonderful things about Hakuin's teaching is it's so in the body. He keeps bringing it back to the body. If at all times, even when coughing, swallowing, waving the arms, when asleep or awake, the practitioner accomplishes everything he decides to do and attains everything that he attempts to attain, and displaying a great, unconquerable determination, he moves forward ceaselessly, he will transcend the emotions and sentiments of ordinary life. His heart will be filled with an extraordinary purity and clarity, as though he were standing on a sheet of ice stretching for thousands of miles. Even if he were to enter the midst of a battlefield or to attend a place of song, dance, and revelry, it would be as though he were where no other person was. He's talking about samadhi in action. Another of these simple kind of in-between periods is when we're taking down dividers or returning the dividers to the tons. Every session now I've seen it begin awkwardly, people trying to figure it out and learning to work together. And then it's just as the session goes on, as the days pass, you see it just, things fall more and more into place. It becomes more fluid, more effortless. This is the functioning of our true mind. In the beginning, there are people who stand passively and lost in thoughts, and others have to take up the slack. And then as time goes on, the thoughts dissipate and clear, people become more responsive, more ready, more on the ball, more active, less afraid of just responding, and less inclined to think that they have to somehow hold on to the practice as if it's this terribly fragile thing that can only sustain if you're motionless and silent. He goes on here, there are some blind, bald idiots who stand in a calm, unperturbed, untouchable place and consider that the state of mind produced in this atmosphere comprises seeing into their own natures. They think that to polish and perfect purity is sufficient, but have never, even in a dream, achieved the state of the person described above. People of this sort spend all day practicing non-action and end up having practiced action all the while. Spend all day practicing non-creating and end up by having practiced creating all the while. Why is this so? It is because their insight into the way is not clear, because they cannot arrive at the truth of the Dharma nature. What a shame it is that they spend in vain this one birth as a human being, a birth so difficult to obtain. They are like blind turtles wandering pointlessly in empty valleys, like demons who guard the wood used for coffins. That they return unreformed in suffering to their old homes in the three evil ways, that's the three lowest realms of existence, hell, hungry ghosts, and animals, is because their practice was badly guided, and from the outset they had not truly seen their own natures. In the past there were men such as Ippen Shonen of the Ji sect, who hung a gong around his neck and, while intoning the Buddha's name, cried out, "Once you enter into the three evil ways, you will never be able to return again." This was a notable person in the Pure Land School. When we consider the human condition as a whole, we see people who lack the merits to be born in heaven, but at the same time do not possess the bad karma that will send them to the three evil realms, so that eventually they end up being born into this degenerate world. Heaven here would be the sixth realm of the highest realm of unenlightened existence, the Deva realm, the heavenly realm, realm of great privilege, wealth, beauty, and other assets, comfort. So they lack the merit to go up that high, to the highest realm of unenlightened existence, but they don't have enough bad karma to be down in the three lowest realms. And so they end up as humans. He says, among them, various emperors, ministers, rich men, and lay Buddhists have in previous lives accumulated considerable good karma. Yet, although their deeds were of a superior nature, they were not sufficient to allow them to be born in heaven. Thus, they were born to wealthy families, surrounded themselves with ministers and concubines, piled up wealth and treasures, and exhibiting no discrimination whatsoever, neither showed sympathy for the common people, nor were willing to reward their retainers. All that they produced was a heart set on luxury. I can't help but think of some stories you read or exposed to in the paper or other places of people, hedge traders, I don't know what that is, but I hear about it. Hedge traders and people who amass these fortunes and but today's evil deeds and causations mean murderous deeds and suffering tomorrow. There are so many instances of people who have come into this world with a substantial amount of merit, but have then recklessly sought after pointless glory, produced a heavy burden of crime, and thus doomed themselves to rebirth in the evil ways. It is an interesting perspective when you hear about people who acquire so much wealth or fame or adulation that that this is the effect of good deeds they've done in the past. Virtue. Not that you have to believe it or disbelieve it, but it's an interesting take. because it's so easy to envy these people. But if we can consider that they did a lot of good for other people in previous lifetimes, and this is the reward. But what is so poignant about it is that there's no safe harbor. Okay, you become a multimillionaire, a billionaire, or a Hollywood star, and then we know very well that you can just tumble out of that for all kinds of reasons. You can lose that status and then plummet into drug and alcohol addiction and all these other things. I think of Britney Spears, this poor girl who's just cascading through these six realms. Skipping a few paragraphs here, he goes on. A long time ago, Chi Po answered the questions of the Yellow Emperor. Quote, when the desiring mind is empty, true energy is in accord with it. If the essence and spirit are guarded within, from where can illness come? That's the end of the question from the Emperor. And then Hakuin says, but people today do not follow this advice. From the time of their births until the time of their deaths, they do not guard within themselves the mind as master. They do not even know what sort of a thing this mind as master is, for they are like ignorant dogs and horses that run around all day just because they have legs. A dangerous ignorance indeed. Don't the writers of military works say, you see how he weaves into his letter to this governor things that the governor might relate to more. This is skillful means on the part of Hakuin. Don't the writers of military works say, surprise and distress arise because the mind as master is not set firmly? End of quote. But when the mind as master is guarded within, distress and fear are not arbitrarily produced. When a person is at any time without the mind as master, he is like a dead man, or at the least, there is no assurance that he will not descend into recklessness and depravity. Let's put it in more contemporary language to... that we from time to time are beset with temptations or distractions, to know that we don't have to give way to these things that are just thoughts, that we do have some choice in the matter. But that's where practice comes in, and training is that without the willpower, without the mind strength to turn away from these thoughts, these enticements or distractions, it becomes very difficult not to do that. But with daily zazen, whether at a training center or at home, doesn't matter. With the daily zazen, we acquire this mind strength, where we can more easily turn away from these things, back to our center, back to our true mind. To illustrate the point, supposing there is an old house owned by an aged woman, decrepit, exhausted, impoverished, and starving. Yet no one will recklessly break into this house while it still has a master. But just let the owner of the house disappear, and thieves will creep in, beggars will sleep in it, foxes and rabbits will race over the floors, and badgers will crawl in to hide. During the day, idle spirits will scream. At night, wild demons will sing there. The house will become a gathering place for numberless weird and evil beings. So it is with the body of man. I remember these paragraphs so vividly from Roshi Kaplow reading them so many sessions. It's kind of, these are oldies but goodies to me. How truly sad. Man is endowed with the wisdom and form of the Buddha. There is nothing that he lacks. Each person is possessed with this treasure jewel that is the Buddha nature, and for all eternity it radiates a great, pure luminescence. But while dwelling in that true land of the pure Dharma nature of Vairochana Buddha, where this very world is the light of nirvana, people, because their eye of wisdom has been blinded, mistake this realm for the ordinary evil world and err in thinking that it is peopled by sentient beings. Sentient beings always, in Buddhist texts, always means unenlightened beings. They err, they make the mistake of thinking that it is peopled by unenlightened beings. In this one birth as a human being, one so difficult to obtain, they spend their time wandering about like ignorant horses and oxen. With no discrimination whatsoever, they extinguish the light and wander through the realms of the three painful evil existences and suffer the sadness of the six forms of rebirth. That's the six realms of unenlightened existence. They grasp at the true land of Vairochana's unchanging eternal calm, and in their fear and delusion cry in pain, believing it to be eternal hell. They pride themselves in their ordinary, pointless, insignificant views, reveling in the small, prejudiced learning that has entered into their mouths and ears. They do not believe in Buddhism, have not listened to the true law, end their days prating nonsense, and have failed to guard even for a moment the mind that is the master of true meditation. More pitiful still is that they revolve for eternal kalpas in the coils of their evil actions. And even more frightening, they earn only the bitter fruit of the long nights of birth and death. Nope. It's so easy to sort of dismiss the stuff, you know, as the kind of the fulminating of a overzealous Zen monk from medieval times. But what if what he says is true about the hells? The coils of our evil actions. Do not say that worldly affairs and pressures of business leave you no time to study Zen under a master, and that the confusions of daily life make it difficult for you to continue your meditation. Shoju Rojin, that was his teacher who threw him off the veranda, kept calling him a hole-dwelling devil. Shoju Rojin always used to say, the man who practices meditation without interruption, even though he may be in a street teeming with violence and murder, even though he may enter a room filled with wailing and mourning, even though he attends wrestling matches and the theater, even though he is present at musical and dance performances, is not distracted or troubled by minutiae, but conscientiously fixes his mind on his koan, proceeds single-mindedly, and does not lose ground. Even if a powerful Asura demon, this is one of the six realms, another of the six realms of unenlightened existence, even if a powerful Asura demon were to seize him by the arm and lead him through innumerable rounds of the great Chiliocosm, his true meditation would not be cut off even for an instant. The Chiliocosm, it says here, is a billion Buddha worlds in the cosmology of Tendai Buddhism. One who continues in this way without interruption can be called a monk who practices the true Zen. At all times, maintain an unconcerned expression on your face, steady your eyes, and never for a moment bother yourself with the affairs of man. Oh, that's all one long quote of Shoju. Now Hakuin says, this statement is truly worthy of respect. Don't we also find in the military laws the instructions, fight and cultivate the fields? This is by far the safest method. Studying Zen is just the same. Meditation is the true practice of fighting. Introspection is the ultimate of cultivation. They are what two wings are to a bird, what two wheels are to a cart. Meditation is the true practice of fighting. It's not fighting against anything. It's fighting to stay one with one's practice. It's not a negative thing. It's not oppositional. We're not trying to combat anything so much as to fight to not allow separation between ourselves and our practice. To stay with it, to stay absorbed in it. It is a fight. It's a tremendous fight, and the fight will become more pitched now in these last two or whatever days of Sesshin. One of the, what I have found to be one of the more predictable enemies of this stage of Sesshin is the tendency of the mind to latch on to a thought or a train of thought or a fantasy of some kind and be so absorbed in it that one doesn't know one is in it. Surely many people here have experienced this, and I think we're more susceptible to it late in Sesshin. It's like this power of concentration, the single-minded absorption gets transferred to some wildly irrelevant scene in the mind or fantasy image, thought, fantasy, and we can get stuck there for kind of a appalling length of time. People report sometimes they can spend a whole round just lost in some particular thought about someone in their family or their work, or without knowing it, just gone. I often have thought it's like Velcro, this laden sesshin. Thoughts can be like Velcro stuck to the mind. Well, there's nothing that can be done about it until we notice it. But once we notice it, God, just let go of it. Get back to the practice. He goes on, if you think that dead sitting and silent illumination are sufficient, then you spend your whole life in error and transgress greatly against the Buddha way. Not only do you set yourself against the Buddha way, but you reject the lay world as well. Why is this so? If the various lords and high officials were to neglect their visits to court and to cast aside their governmental duties and practice dead sitting and silent illumination, if the warriors were to neglect their archery and charioteering, forget the martial arts, and practice dead sitting and silent illumination, if the merchants were to lock their shops and smash their abacuses and practice dead sitting and silent illumination, if the farmers were to throw away their plows and hoes, cease their cultivation, and practice dead sitting in silent illumination. If craftsmen were to cast away their measures and discard their axes and adzes and practice dead sitting in silent illumination, the country would collapse and the people drop with exhaustion. Bandits would arise everywhere and the nation would be in grievous danger. Here too you see his appealing to the governor's sense of public responsibility. Then the people in their anger and resentment would be sure to say that Zen was an evil and an ill-omened thing. But it should be known that at the time that the ancient monasteries flourished, old sages such as Nan Wei, Ma Zu, Bo Chang, Huang Po, Lin Ji, Hui Zong, Ma Yu, Xing Hua, Pa Shang, Shou Pang, and Ti Tang, and others heaved stones, moved earth, drew water, cut firewood, and grew vegetables. When the drum for the work period sounded, they tried to make progress in the midst of their activity. That is why Po Chang said, "A day without work, a day without eating." This practice is known as meditation in the midst of activity, the uninterrupted practice of meditation sitting. This style of Zen practice no longer exists today. I do not mean to say, however, that sitting in meditation should be despised. Of all the sages, the men of wisdom of the past and of today, there is not one that perfected the Buddha way who do not depend on Zen meditation. The three essentials, the precepts, meditation, and wisdom, have always been the very center of Buddhism. Who would dare to take them lightly? But if anyone should have attempted to approach such men as the great Zen sages mentioned above, men who transcend both sect and rank, while they were engaged in the true, unsurpassed, great Zen meditation, lightning would have flashed, and the stars would have leaped about in the sky. How then can someone with the eye of a sheep or the wisdom of foxes and badgers expect to judge such men? Even should there be such a thing as attaining the status of a Buddha or reaching a state where the great illumination is released by means of dead sitting and silent illumination, the various lords, high stewards, and common people are so involved in the numerous duties of their household affairs that they have scarcely a moment in which to practice concentrated meditation. What they do then is to plead illness and, neglecting their duties and casting aside responsibilities for their family affairs, they shut themselves up in a room for several days, lock the door, arrange several cushions in a pile, set up a stick of incense, and proceed to sit. Yet, because they are exhausted by ordinary worldly cares, they sit in meditation for 1 minute and fall asleep for 100. Sounds familiar, anyone? And during the little bit of meditation that they manage to accomplish, their minds are beset by countless delusions. As soon as they set their eyes, grit their teeth, clench their fists, adjust their posture, and start to sit, 10,000 evil circumstances begin to race about in their minds. Thereupon they furrow their brows, draw together their eyebrows, and before one knows it, they are crying out, "Our official duties interfere with our practice of the way. Our careers prevent our Zen meditation. It would be better to resign from office, discard our seals, go to some place beside the water or under the trees where all is peaceful and quiet and no one is about, there in our own way to practice Zazen and escape from the endless cycle of suffering." And then Hakuin says, "How mistaken these people are." Well, I have to say that I can't imagine Hakuin not approving of this accommodation that has become so helpful in our busy lay lives, which is to continue with our jobs, with our households, our families, children, and then still have the wisdom to understand that that from time to time we have to carve out some space to get to Sesshin. This has become the vehicle for so many people now in Western countries to maintain a daily practice of sitting as well as one can, but then plunge into this intensified form of it. Because in this intensified structure, we have the best chance of reaching deeper beyond ourselves into places of deep quiet and expansiveness that would be very difficult at home. The sitting at home is indispensable. We can't make sitting just another thing in our to-do list to try to squeeze in, competing with everything else. We can't do that. Zazen is not just another activity. It is the basis of activity. It is that which enhances, enriches all of our activities. It can't be allowed to atrophy. And then if one can from time to time do it in this Sesshin manner, this can be enough to carry one very far in practice. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.